Hello, this is Anjali Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Story time, 9 o'clock horses, episode 7. I had always known my mother was very superstitious. Don't cross knives in the sink or on the tabletop, Amelia. Or, oh dear, did you see the new moon through glass? That's bad luck. Better throw some salt over your left shoulder. If I forgot something when I left the house and went back inside, I was told to sit down and raise my feet off the floor. It seemed that bad luck would find us if we didn't obey the superstitions that plagued her on a daily basis. Her oddness in many ways did not usually include leaving the house 2 or 3 evenings a week. Now it seemed to be a regular occurrence. I assumed it was because she had recently been approached by the local church and was attending their meetings. When I asked, she said it really wasn't our business to know. After that comment, I was worried. I seriously considered stalking my own mother. But one evening, she came home with a lovely gold brooch to show me. "Isn't this beautiful?" she said, turning the brooch over and over in her hand. "It belonged to Alice MacDonald down the street." "She gave it to you?" I asked. "Oh, no, she's dead. Her sister gave it to me. See if I can get in touch with Alice." She must have noticed the blank look on my face because she said, "You didn't know I could get in touch with spirits, did you? They tell me I have a gift." I shivered involuntarily. "Why would you do that?" I finally asked. "Why? Because everyone wants to know about their loved ones when they're dead." "When they're dead?" Mother smiled. "Oh yes, I can get through to Alice by holding this brooch in my hand. She talks to me. There's nothing strange about it, you know. Did you really believe that life on earth is all there is?" I was at the door ready to leave the room and all the strange talk when she said, "Mother talks to me all the time. We communicate often. It's comforting to me." At that moment, a tingle of the old fear crept up my spine. Was she really mentally ill, I wondered. After all, she had been in a mental hospital. "I'll tell you one thing," she said. "My mother has helped me a lot. And she's even said she was sorry when I was a kid and she frightened me with the 9 o'clock horses." The 9 o'clock horses had been a mystery for all of us, so I went back and seated myself opposite her. "What is all that about?" I asked. Seated in her chair, staring intently into the coal fire that was the only source of heat in the whole house, she finally looked up at me. "Terrifying," she said. I could see she was uncomfortable talking to me now. I wondered if I should just leave and tell it was all right. I didn't need to know. But then she smiled. "Oh, yes, those horses. Charging down the street at 9 o'clock. Every night they came." My curiosity was really piqued now. "Why were the horses coming down the street, Mom?" "Oh, you don't understand," she said, running her hands through her hair. "I was just a child, only 7 or 8. I loved to play whip and top in the street in the summer. Mother would call out to me, 'If you don't come in now, the 9 o'clock horses will come and get you.' The problem is, I still hear them. Quite often. I hear them now. I hear them clattering down the street, 4 horses dragging a wooden wheeled dray loaded with 6 large barrels with water, spraying from each barrel. Can you imagine the terrible racket they made?" As I studied my mother's face, I could see she was slipping away from me to another time and place. I had to bring her back. I raised my voice. "I think it was cruel of Grandma to say that to you," I said. "What were the horses doing running down the street anyway?" She looked up, obviously trying to concentrate on me. It took her a moment. "You know how narrow Grey Street is?" Silence. Then, "It's been there 400 years. There were no sewers at one time, not like today. Folks would tip their chamber pots out the bedroom windows. God knows what diseases there were. Anyway, I didn't know it at the time. There was a fire station at the end of our street. Every night at 9, the street would be washed with gallons of water that spewed from the wooden barrels. My, oh my, what a terrible sound they made. A wooden wheel dray, heavy with water. 4 horses. You know how cobbled that street is. Again the vacant look, eyes unblinking, was just how she had looked when I saw her in the mental hospital. For the first time in a long time, I felt compassion for a woman whose childhood memories still plagued her, and the fact that she still heard noises in her head. I leaned forward to hug her. "They're gone now," I said. "Can't you just forget them?" "But they're still there," she whispered. Her words made me shiver, and once again I realized I really didn't know my mother at all. With the uneasy thoughts floating about my mother around my head, I had pushed the episode with Douglas to the very back of my mind. I told myself it was something that maybe he regretted, and since he did seem to be acting quite normally now around me, why worry about it? The months of feeling secure came to an end when I arrived home late from the dance and noticed only the hall light shining through the leaded glass pane on the front door. I tiptoed into the living room and was just about to go into the kitchen when I heard the creak of the third step on the stairs. It was Douglas. He closed the living room door behind him. He stood there in his pajamas, just staring at me. "What do you want?" I said, hoping I didn't sound as frightened as I was. "What is it now?" "You know what I want," he said. His voice was harsh. "Come on!" I could feel the heat rise to my cheeks. "Leave me alone. If you come any closer, I'll scream. I really will. I'll wake Mum and Dad." "Oh, come on, please, sis." He lurched at me and I lost my balance and staggered back until I fell onto the sofa. He was so strong, I was straddled half on and half off. My legs were trapped beneath him. I tried to push him off, but he was so heavy. I had to think what to do, not to panic. I reached over my head and felt for the pile of books I knew were on the table behind the sofa. I managed to pick one up and swung it at his head with all my might. It wasn't a heavy book, but it made him blink and shake his head. For a minute, his weight lessened. I rolled over onto my side, heaved myself up, raced for the door, up the stairs and into my bedroom. The slider lock was stiff, but I managed to push it across. I lay on the bed, my heart beating like mad. That night I hardly slept, worrying and wondering what to do. In the morning, my mother said, "You look as though you slept in your makeup." I said, "I did." For a brief moment, I thought of telling her about my brother and his immoral behavior to me, his sister. The scenario of what I would say rang through my mind, but I couldn't do it. I'm not sure why. Except I had the notion she wouldn't believe me. She'd already hinted that my bleached blonde hair and my berry pink lipstick attracted the wrong type of man. I saw myself as pretty. Colin and Kevin had told me I was. I started to look at ads in the newspaper for available rooms to share, flats to let that I could afford. Every evening for the next week, I made it my mission to travel to various areas in the city where I saw lots of dingy rooms to share and flats too expensive for my budget. Kevin came to see me at work to ask if I was okay. It was not like me to miss any dance classes, he said. It was my lunch hour. We walked down the crowded street among the shoppers. I told him everything. He didn't speak for a long time. He just looked at me and shook his head. Then he stopped and pulled me into a wide doorway of a store, away from the melee crowding the sidewalk. "Look," he said, "my folks' house is very big, and they have a room they sometimes rent out. Why don't you come and live with us?" I said that was kind, and I'd think about it. but I did mention that I was scared to go home that night after the dance class. It was a relief. It was a relief when he suggested he could wait in front of the house until I signaled by turning the light on and off in my bedroom. I could hear the radio as soon as we got to the front door. My mother was still up. I was safe. I said good night to Kevin and thanked him for the ride home. The radio was on full blast. Music blared into the room. My mother poured sherry into the glass until it slopped over the side. She said, "I saw you in that car with that man. He's too old for you." "He's just my dance partner." "What about Colin? Doesn't he mind you're out every night with this other chap?" Too much sherry, I thought. "It's not every night, and Colin is in London, you know that. Anyway, he doesn't like dancing." I realized we were shouting at each other, and I went to the radio and turned it down. "Leave it," she said, turning it back up. The music was even louder. I said, "You'll wake everybody, and I have to go to bed. Please turn it down." "Just leave it." Her eyes were blazing. "I'm surprised you don't ask your father to go dancing with you. He's going to ask you to go with him to the gun club dinner, he told me." "What dinner?" I asked. "His precious gun club with all his stuck-up friends. It's their annual do." "I don't know anything about that," I said. "Oh, he's been nice to you because he knows I never wanted you. You were an accident. After Pauline and Douglas, I never wanted any children. No more kids." She lit up a cigarette and took a deep draw before she went on. "I'd already left him, you know, your father. We were separated, and I had rented one of those houses on Woodman Road. He knew where I was. He got what he wanted. He was a randy old sod. He liked sex. I never did. This time he got around me and I got pregnant. You were the reason I had to come back to this place, a council house." Her words cut me like a knife, and I physically winced. I was suddenly drained, and at the same time I was trying to imagine my father and mother ever being intimate. Why that thought came to me at that moment was a mystery. But now my temper took over. "I'm sorry I was born to you," I said. "Now I'm going to bed, and I'd like it quiet, please." I walked out of the room and went to the pantry in the hall. With a snap, I turned off the electricity at the meter. There was a very strange system of paying for electricity in council houses. The meter had to be fed with shillings for so many hours of electricity. It wasn't unusual to forget, and the lights would suddenly go out. I heard my mother come into the hall. She shoved me aside and turned the switch back on. You bitch," she said as the lights came back on. Music from the radio boomed across the room. Just then there was a loud knock at the door. I opened it. I even thought it might be the police with all the ranting and shouting going on. But it was Kevin standing there. "Get your suitcase," he said. "You're coming home with me." He had heard the music and the diatribe between me and my mother. I didn't know how I was going to explain to my father why I was leaving late that night, but I didn't care. As I left the house and got into Kevin's car, I could still hear music blaring. My father came to see me at work the next day. He pleaded with me to come home. He thought it was just because of my mother that I'd left, and I didn't enlighten him about Douglas. I told him it was better that I left home for a while. I had just turned 18, and he knew he could not legally force me to live at home. After a few minutes, he shook his head. "I'm so sorry, dear. Vicky's really still not well, you know. Maybe it is better you're not at home, but I do want you to go with me to the gun club dinner and dance. Will you do that?" "Yes, I will. I'd love to," I said. "Although, it won't help your relationship with Mom." "I know, Amelia, but I have my life to live too." It was a surprise when he suddenly turned to me and hugged me. That was a first. At the dinner dance, I wore a turquoise cotton summer dress with a halter neckline. I could tell by the attention I received from his friends that he was proud of me. It was an elegant affair, with lovely place settings and several different wine glasses for an aperitif, wine, and port. We were still sitting at the long table after dinner when he smiled at a girl who passed by our table. Her hair was auburn. He looked at me. A smile hovered around his lips. She looks a lot like Violet. Ah, yes, I said, you told me about Violet. Yes, that was a long time ago. It's funny, isn't it? How I mark time with our wars. 1916. First World War was in full swing. What was that war all about? I asked. Well, I suppose it was because of the balance of power in Europe and unresolved territorial disputes. He shook his head. Can you imagine? 16 million young men died in that war, in the trenches, and 7 million civilians. It was probably triggered by the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife in Austria. You should read up on that sometime. Do I need to know all about the wars? I asked. No, it is our history, though, he said. Then he sighed. I'll never forget her. He was still thinking about Violet. I was suddenly overwhelmed by a feeling of sadness for my father. He was a good man, trying his best to provide for his family, despite the odd relationship with my mother. Do you ever think about a divorce? I said. What? Well, you put up a lot of weird things with her, and no one would blame you if you split up. Everyone knows how she is. He was obviously shocked that I should propose such a thing, because he raised his eyebrows and frowned at me. There's never been a divorce in my family, not ever in the Nortons. Well, what does it matter? It matters to me. So you'd rather live in misery than try to have some happiness with someone else? You're not that old. I'm certain you could find another woman, I said. Now you're being ridiculous. How would your mother manage on her own? I couldn't help sighing. Well, you've been led quite a dance with Mum, as far as I can see. I mean, she tried to kill herself twice. She does act a bit strange, don't you think? He said nothing as I continued. I was little when you told her not to touch the gun, but she did. In fact, when I think about it, it's cowardly to try and end your life when you have a young family. My God, I was only 7 when she did that. He put his hand on my arm and turned to face me. Amelia, perhaps you should know that you have that wrong. She wasn't trying to kill herself. She was trying to kill me. This is the end of episode 7. Please listen to episode 8 next week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.